Yes, Mr. Chair, I so approve.
Thank you. MICA had to put a microphone in front of me so you guys could hear me, but anyway. Motion to approve the minutes. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion carries. Representative Zhang, you're up with the first bill. And before we get going here, members, I have a couple bills up in higher ed, so I'm going to listen to part of the presentation after Representative Zhang's bill, and then I got to go over and do a couple higher ed bills. So anyway, that's what will be going on this afternoon. Representative Zhang, would you care to move House File 889 for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill?
Thank you, Mr. Yes, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd like to move House File 889 for to be laid over to be possibly included in the omnibus bill.
Omnibus finance bill.
Omnibus finance bill.
Thank you, Ms. Representative Zhang. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill originally was drafted by Representative Detmer to remove outdated language to streamline the definitions for eligibility for the Minnesota GI Bill. What I'm told is that it eliminates language from when the Minnesota GI Bill was limited to post 9/11 veterans. The Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs Education Director indicated that the change would not affect current eligibility to the current program. It's just a cleanup language bill. And if there are any questions, Mr. Johnson is here from the NDVA to answer.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Zhang. Mr. Johnson, do you have any comments on? Okay. And like Representative Zhang talked about, this is just a cleanup language. Any questions from the committee?
Great.
Mr. Chair. Representative Detmer.
Just a quick question to the author. And what brought on the need for the change? Was that something that was brought to you by the department?
Mr. Chair, this was brought to me by Senator Newton. I was told that it was brought up in the previous years and did not go through, and just wanted to be brought to clean up languages. That's unnecessary.
And Mr. Chair, and then another question. Does it change or exclude any veterans from eligibility from the
Is that it does not change anything.
From the GI Bill?
Representative Zhang?
Mr. Chair, Representative Demmer, my understanding is that it does not change anything unless there is something.
Maybe the department could address that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Johnson, could you address that, please? Please identify yourself.
Chair Eklund, members of the committee, my name is Ben Johnson. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. It's my understanding that the representative, the author, is correct. It does not change or eliminate eligibility. It simply makes it easier for veterans to understand that they are eligible for the Minnesota GI Bill program. As it stands, in 2007, between 2007 and 2009, the Minnesota GI Bill was expanded to include other veterans beyond just the post 9/11 veterans. So the goal here was to make it easier for schools to understand which veteran students would be eligible. As it stands now, MDVA is the one interpreting discharge paperwork and identifying eligibility for the Minnesota GI Bill. So we have no issues with this bill and the language that it removes.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson.
Any other questions from the committee? Anybody from the audience care to testify for or against this bill? All right, Representative Zhang renews his motion that House File 889 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, you might as well stay right there because you're up. And since you've identified yourself, you can proceed with your presentation. And members, while they're getting ready, you have the budget book here. Please leave it. It'll keep it with your with our materials for each committee meeting. So, thank you.
Chair Eklund, members of the committee, again, my name is Ben Johnson. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And we'd like to take you through our biennial budget request. The recommendations based on Governor Wall's direction. I'd also allow my counterpart here to introduce himself as well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Powers. I'm the CFO for the agency.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Powers.
Thank you.
So, Chair, members, I'd like to start with a quick overview of the mission of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. We are dedicated to serving Minnesota's veterans and their families, approximately 327,000 veterans in the state of Minnesota. We look to provide innovative programs, services, and trying to maximize their quality of life. We're also monitoring and adapting to emerging needs, so when there are opportunities to create new programs and services or new care in our homes, we are able to adapt and provide those things. There are a couple of change items that we will highlight that indicate some areas of new opportunity for veterans and their families we're excited about. We'd also like to point out that our long-term care and skilled nursing facilities continue to expand the kind of operations that we can provide. And I want to make sure to highlight that as well. We've got some opportunities in here where we think we can provide better service and care or on par service and care with some efficiencies that we've identified as well. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to the CFO.
Mr. Chair and committee members, MDVA's 2021 base budget consists of $280.2 million for the biennium. Of that, $150.8 million is a direct fund appropriation, and the breakdown of the $150.8 million is $116.6 million is transferred to the Special Revenue Fund to operate the veterans' homes. And the other $34.2 million are funds that are used for the veterans' programs and services. So those are the direct general fund appropriation. We collect $113.3 million for veterans' homes, for the VA per diems, resident maintenance fees, Medicare reimbursements, and we're estimating that we'll see increases of 4% per year for those revenues. We also have $3.7 million in special revenue funds for reimbursement for cemetery fees and federal reimbursements, along with the SOT license plate revenue that we receive. We're estimating about a 26.5% increase to the cemetery and federal reimbursement fees as we ramp up Preston, now that's been open for a couple of years now, and then the Duluth just opened up here last year, so we'll see increases in revenues there. We also have approximately $4.6 million in resident trust and gift accounts. About $1 million of that is actually the gift accounts. And then we use $7.8 million of the $12 million of the open appropriation for the Minnesota GI Bill. If we go to the next slide, shows you the breakdown of the expenditures by fund. What you see here is the general fund portion is basically the programs and services. On the first slide, we had the $34.2 million. Because we transfer the 116.6, that's now showing up in the special revenue fund. As you can see, we spend 82.5% of our expenditures occur within that fund, which is made up of the VA per diem, maintenance fees, and reimbursements, along with that 116.6 general fund appropriation. And then you can see the breakdown of the restricted special revenue funds, trust funds, and gifts fund, or just a small portion of that by fund. In the middle there is the expenditures by program, and you can see the distribution between the health care and veterans programs and services. Along the right there is the expenditures by category. You can see we spend 72.6% of our budget on compensation. The other operating expenses at 18.6 and 8.5 for grants, aids, and subsidies. Interesting to note, the capital outlay is fairly minimal. In years past, of course, we've had the construction at the Minneapolis campus, along with the cemeteries that would show up in this category, and we have none going in 20 and 21 as of right now.
Next up, we've got Governor Walz's recommended budget change items for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. They fall in four broad categories, a couple of specific items as well. So I'd like to go through each of those. First up, our goal is to maintain access for veterans to MDVA state programs. The original general fund appropriation, the governor recommends an additional appropriation of $544,000 in the 2020-21 biennium for our programs and services to maintain the current level of care. The current level of delivery it would be sustained with this. It does suggest an increase in FTEs, but that is not the case. That is simply the cost of an FTE. We would have the same number of FTEs working in this area. We think we can continue to offer programs and capacity, but because of the increases in things like employer-paid health care contributions, FICA and Medicare, along with salary and compensation-related costs, in order to keep pace with those that have been agreed upon, this would maintain the same level of services that we can provide. I'd like to highlight a couple of areas that I think are important. In years past, the number of veterans and their dependents who have had MDVA acting as their accredited representative with the VA, this is a group of individuals who process claims or appeals with the VA at the federal level. In 2016, we represented just over 51,000 veterans. Last year, we increased that in scope by 3,000 more, up to almost 55,000 veterans. That's through our programs and services, the claims department. The number of Minnesota GI Bill participants approved for higher education, OJT, and apprenticeship programs. In 2016, we were just over 1,000 participants, and by the end of fiscal year 17, we had increased that to 1,470 participants. These are the kinds of programs that we are able to offer, and we would need to see this increase in funding in order to keep the same level of staffing and provide the same level of opportunities. One other area I'd like to highlight that I think is important is some increases that we've seen. The GI Bill funds increases over 2017 increased by 12.5%. Our Tribal Veteran Service Officers claims have increased 6% over 2017. So these are the kinds of people that we're reaching with our programs and services. Again, the increase is necessary to maintain the current level. It's not to add any additional FTEs. Next on the agenda
Mr. Chair, quick question.
Mr. Johnson, Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson. On page 10 of the governor's budget here, fiscal year 2020, I see a 2.3 FTE. On page 10, I see a 2.3 FTE. Could you maybe explain that, and then maybe explain where those FTEs are going to be working?
Sure.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Detmer, primarily those are areas that we would have to cut. Within the education and claims areas is what we would have to cut those positions in order to fund the rest of the program. So it equates to about 2.3 FTEs, and then 5 FTEs and 20. Is that correct? No. Pardon me.
Page 10.
Mr. Chair, so what I understand, if you don't get the budget, that's what you would have to cut, or these are adding FTEs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Detmer, yes, that's true.
So the next item that we would like to address is a recommendation to increase funding a total of $775,000 to operate the three state veteran cemeteries. I'd like to highlight that the original general fund appropriations for each cemetery are different for each location depending on when they came online. For instance, Little Falls has been online for well over two decades. The initial appropriation to operate that cemetery was about $347,000. Preston came online at $425,000, and Duluth was recently approved, and funding there is at $500,000. So this request would put them all on the same field, all on the same playing level, It would increase their base level general funding. Each one would be at $550,000. This is about the equivalent of 7.4 FTEs per location. And really the goal is just to make sure that the general fund is taking care of the operational costs. This is salary and benefits for the employees. This is not purchasing equipment. There are separate funds for that. But the goal is to get them all on the same level playing field. And if you're looking at the governor's budget book, page 13, you can see some of the representations of these pre-registration numbers, which is a good way to indicate what volume is going to look like at some of these cemeteries, or the annual burial numbers. Again, these are two graphs on page 13. Duluth is not yet on the annual burial numbers and is only coming online in pre-registration numbers. We're having our official grand opening at Memorial Day this coming year for the official ribbon cutting ceremony. But the goal here is to make sure that they all will be able to operate at the same capacity. We expect we'll continue to see pre-registration numbers increasing at Preston and Duluth. We want to make sure that we have the manpower sufficient to operate these cemeteries at the same level so that no matter which cemetery your family chooses for the loved ones, they're receiving the same level of care. Third item, the governor's recommendation is for an increase of funding, $250,000 per year for the Minnesota CORE program. The CORE program has seen a significant increase in enrollment, over 65% between 2014 and 2018, and last year served 822 veterans and their families statewide. This is an important program and a collaboration. We have a relationship with Lutheran Social Services, and we have a demonstrated need, and the reason that we're coming looking for additional funding is because the current programmatic need outweighs the programmatic capacity. We're limited by funding for the number of veterans and their families that we can serve. So, for instance, during the fiscal year 2018, we had to implement cost-saving measures, checking clients for insurance. Now, we're actually proud of the work that has been done to make sure that we're using any available means that a veteran has in order to provide this care. But if they have insurance, we want their primary insurance carrier to be billing first before the state general fund is paying for it. LSS, Lutheran Social Services, inserted contract language with their third-party providers to make sure that this billing of a primary care insurance provider is being taken care of. And finally, the other cost-saving measure that we would like to avoid going forward is we had to reduce the amount of time that a client counseling session went on from an hour down to 45 minutes. That allowed us to spend more money on more veterans, the same amount of money on more veterans, but we were significantly short during that fiscal year. And again, I'll go back to the highlights. The number of veterans that we've served in this capacity over the last 5 years has increased from 498 to 575 to 748 to last year 822. And we believe there's a demonstrated need in the community, and we would not want to see a lack of funding be the reason that we're not able to get the right kind of care and services to these veterans and their families.
Mr. Chair, just a quick, Mr. Johnson, as you're going through, I'm trying to follow through also on the governor's book. Could you explain to the committee what do you mean by pre-registration numbers and the chart on 13? And also the actual burial numbers, and then how that applies to your increase in FTEs. Right now, how many are employed at each cemetery as we speak? So these increases are, these 5.0 or 5.25, those are increases, am I correct?
Mr. Johnson.
Chair, Representative Detmer, those numbers would represent getting us to the right size of service providers at each of those cemeteries. We're not quite there yet with Duluth because it's only been open. We did our soft opening last November. So the goal is to get them all onto the same page. And they do vary from cemetery to cemetery. One of the things that is not counted in this is that, like, for instance, the number of volunteer hours. I think Little Falls last year had more than 2,000 volunteer hours contributed by members of the community who are not FTEs. The other part of it is that they're seasonal FTEs, so a 0.2 or a 0.5 or someone that's full-time through the summer and then is not on the payroll the rest of the year. But these increases, uh, The increases in FTEs are to provide the right kind of services. We've identified what the right mix of landscapers and, you know, each one has an administrator. We've got one person at least in each doing the administration of the paperwork, getting families in, doing the pre-registration process. We work collaboratively with the county veteran service officers. But in terms of the base FTEs, we are at where we want to be, but going forward, we feel that we can't continue to maintain the correct level of FTE staffing if we don't have an increase at, in particular, Little Falls and Preston.
And Mr. Chair, for some committee members who have not visited, say, Little Falls or any of the cemeteries, could you maybe, Mr. Johnson, just kind of give us an idea how many are employed there right now? Is there shifts? Is there early shift, late shift, or whatever? And how would this increase in FTEs help with serving the veteran population?
Chair Representative Demmer, I'd have to get back to you with specific counts for the positions that we've got up there. I do have the full breakdown of that. Like I said, in the summertime it's much busier, but it is staffing to do landscaping and burial. It's the folks that would be doing the care of the just mowing lawns, things like that. But I'm happy to provide the committee members with a breakdown of that and why this is an important increase to get everyone at the same
time. Yeah, Mr. Chair, that would help because, committee members that have never visited one of our veterans cemeteries would have a better concept of how they're maintained and the work that goes into it. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, if I might ask, are these cemeteries, I assume, they're different sizes, so you probably need maybe different staffing levels for each one. I don't imagine they're not cookie cutters, so they're not all the same size.
Chair, you're correct that they're not the same size in terms of the land covered or even how much is open yet. For instance, Duluth has been designed to be open in sections as those are coming online. The current staffing is at Little Falls is for a mature cemetery operation. Preston's coming online and Duluth as well. So Preston's been open for about 5 years. To Representative Detmer's question about the idea of pre-registration numbers, that's families anticipating the need for burial. And so we get them processing, and it gives us a sense of what kind of volume we will have for memorials and services, interments and interments in the future. And so we're trying to anticipate that as we have more pre-registrations, we've got an opportunity to be able to bring these up to capacity. And that's what we've done with Preston and Duluth coming in at smaller funding numbers. But as with the programs and services discussion, these aren't static payrolls. As people mature in their positions, they've got step increases the same as other state employees. They've got the known increases in insurance and things like that. So we believe that with this funding and as state increased now and then stable going forward, that we can provide the same operations at everyone. Obviously, staffing will be right-sized. I think we only have five FTEs at Duluth at the moment. Eventually, it would be to the 7.4 position. But the mix of staff, again, depends on some of them would be part-time employees, 0.2 or 0.5 FTEs. So, but I will absolutely get this information to the committee.
Thank you.
So finally, on the list of change items for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs would be a general fund budget reduction of $1.06 million in fiscal year 2020 and 2021. This is for the Veterans Healthcare Program at our state veterans' homes. The reduction is a result of the MDVA contracting with medical service providers and physicians and nurse practitioners in three of the state veterans' homes. What we would do is ensure that service providers are delivering care up to the top of their individual licensure and expertise. We think we can do that. We can do that in a more efficient and effective model of care if we are contracting outside of the agency. So this will actually result in a reduction in FTEs. Part of it is attrition, and part of it is just right-sizing positions, making sure that we've got the right mix of care providers in any in this capacity. The result of this is you can see the FTE reduction of 4.85 in fiscal year 2020 and ongoing. If I could, I'd like to turn it over to the CFO to talk briefly about the breakdown of what we're looking at in general fund and what we're looking at in savings. Should I switch to the next slide for that one?
Sure.
Okay. The change from the 2021 base of $150.8 million will now go to $151.6. It's only a half a percent increase. And the change by programs for the veterans homes at 116.6 would go to the 115.5. There's a 1% decrease there. And for programs and services, 34.3 to 36.1, so it's a 4.9% increase. Down below shows you the four change items there and the impact to the general fund, so there'd be an increase of $759,000 for the biennium. And the bullet below that, there'd be no change to the other revenue funds except for the reduction of the medical services provider of $940,000. And the reason for that is the per diems and maintenance fees primarily account for about 47% of the funding for the veterans homes, and the other 53% comes from the general fund. So that's the reason for the split there. And then off to the right there, you can see our change from 1,246 FTEs to 1,241 FTEs, 5 FTE reduction there.
Chair, members of the committee, again, thank you for your attention and your interest in working to make sure that the veterans of this state have the best possible care. With that, I would like to open it up to any other questions or concerns you may have. But as noted, in the interest of time, I'm happy to continue to answer questions offline or in another capacity. But that concludes our testimony, Chair.
Thank you.
Time.
Thank you.
Next, we have the Mr. Don Kerr.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Department of Military Affairs, and I also will spend about 15 minutes giving you a budget overview. As Mr. Johnson said, I'd also be happy to answer any follow-up questions or provide more materials to the members of the committee at any time with regard to our budget. And with that, I'll go ahead and move ahead. This is the agenda I'll follow. And I'm going to spend most of the time during the briefing today on our change items. But again, I'd be happy to respond back to any questions you may have about other aspects of the budget. So the first pie chart that I've got up, let me go to my notes here. This depicts the annual amounts for our three state appropriations in the current budget fiscal year. So the total amount this year is $22.929, or nearly $23 million in 2019. About 42% of that amount is used for the maintenance and upkeep of our training facilities. And even though we're able to use federal matching funds for this, over the long term, this amount is still insufficient for what we need. However, we don't have any short-term concerns due to the generosity of the legislature and the bonding cycle and the adjustments that we've made to our budget in previous years. It would be possible for you to give us too much money into maintenance appropriation because we wouldn't be able to match it with federal funds, and we prefer to match it all with federal funds so we can make it go further for the taxpayers. So we feel we're pretty close to where we need to be right now with the maintenance appropriation. About 44% of our state budget is appropriated to our enlistment incentives program, and most of this funding is used to reimburse tuition paid for by our soldiers and airmen that are attending college and trade schools. Now, this is an important program that helps us recruit and maintain the quality of our force, and it also helps our members improve their educational level and their relative value to our economy. So this is a comparison of what's in the governor's recommendation for 2020. This is a one-year snapshot, so it's consistent with the previous. You'll notice there's an added appropriation, and I should talk about this. We actually have four appropriations in the general support account. One of them we generally don't talk about. That's the emergency services appropriation. We don't talk about that because we can't really control it. That's an open appropriation. When we're called to active service and the governor declares an emergency, that's an open appropriation. And so we can't really forecast what that's going to be. MMB does forecast that amount. They actually take an eight-year average, throw out the high and low, and put that into their budget data. But we don't really pay any attention to it because it's going to cost what it's going to cost. And we won't try to bring the war in your budget. But you will see that we did add an appropriation, a fourth one, that little sliver of yellow in there. And I'll talk about that when we get to the change items in more detail. So the total amount is $24.197 million dollars for both 20 and 21. That's an increase of $1.268 million per year. And that is $1 million, $1.01 million actually, an enlistment incentives appropriation and a $258,000 increase for the new reintegration appropriation. And again, I'll speak a little bit more about that later. So this gives a little bit of history, and I'm going to use three slides that look like this through the presentation. This gives a budget history of the last four biennia about where our budget has been, and you can see the sub-appropriations within that. Back in 16-17, we came to the legislature and requested a fundamental structural change to our budget to improve our maintenance posture. So at that time, our enlistment appropriation and enlistment incentives appropriation has had carry forward authority, and we were carrying forward a fairly large balance, $20 million were the balance, as a matter of fact. And we came to the legislature and asked that we be allowed to move $10 million of that carry forward into our maintenance appropriations for some one-time fixes, and the other $10 million we would use to spend down our enlistment incentives by for the future year. So you'll see that our actual spending in enlistment incentives went way down in 16-17 from our appropriated funds and then went back up again in 18-19. When I go to the next slide, this is the same slide but with one other thing added. This shows in 16-17 the effect of that carry forward in the maintenance, the enlistment incentives appropriation and how we actually had quite a bit more spending in 16-17 beyond what was appropriated because we were using, as we had planned, that carry forward funding. And then the 18-19 numbers, we actually did a slight reduction in spending from the previous year because we didn't have as much carry forward available. So with that in mind, you're going to see something very similar to that slide again in a minute. There are two change item requests. The first one is an annual general fund increase of $1 million in each year into the enlistment incentive program. That will allow us to continue to offer the state tuition reimbursement program at its current level. And the second request is to add this appropriation for reintegration programs. And we have actually been conducting those reintegration programs. We're doing that from a one-time appropriation that we received in 2008 of $1.5 million. And over the last decade, we've actually spent that down, and it's time to come back in and look at how we can replenish those funds. And MMB asked us, rather than going in for another lump sum, to try to move it into the base appropriation. It's easier for them to manage that way. We agreed with that, so did the governor. So that's what we're doing. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about that first request, and they're all in here. But this is the same slide you saw. You'll notice that yellow band, that was our carry-forward authority, and then we've added the proposed amount for 2021, and you'll note that it's the same level that we were at in 18-19.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Demmer? Mr. Chair, Mr. Kirk, could you explain to the committee the reintegration program for
Mr. Kirk?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer, if I've got that coming up in about three slides, if you don't mind, I'll wait till then and be happy to hit that again if I need to. But that's kind of where that is. But let's go on to this slide. So within the state enlistment incentives appropriation, these are the five major programs that we have. State tuition reimbursement program, which is the vast majority of it. The state enlistment bonus, which was suspended in September of 17, and the state reenlistment bonus, which we also suspended in September of 17, our state medic bonus, which remains in effect, and our state reclassification bonus, which is an important part of our program and also remains in effect. And then from this appropriation, we also have two FTEs that we have been paying for a long time and expect to continue. To give you an idea of the volatility of the state tuition reimbursement program, we track two real big things here. Obviously, the total amount that we expend, but also the average number of users and the number of payments that we make. And we think that's illustrative because In a perfect world, what we think we would see is about twice as many payments per user. That would indicate that a full-time college student is getting two payments from us a year, one for each of the big semesters. There are sometimes when they get three, there are sometimes when they get one. But this gives us a pretty good idea of how many people are using the program and what the dollar value is of the program.
And Mr. Chair, and Mr. Kerr, on page 9, the state reenlistment bonus, the SRB, why was that suspended in 17?
Mr. Chair, we suspended those two programs as part of the effort that we had to make to live within the means that we were being provided within the enlistment incentives appropriation. And I think you'll see, again, our big challenge is trying to, we had a couple of things happen, and again, we'll get to that in a minute, but one was we have been able to offset a lot of our costs in the state tuition reimbursement program by utilizing a federal program, the Federal Tuition Assistance Program. And about 3 years ago, maybe four, that's in my slide, I shouldn't be speculating, the Army changed the eligibility requirements for the Federal Tuition Assistance Program and restricted our members' eligibility to use it. And when that became unavailable, we had to use more money out of the state tuition reimbursement program to allow them to continue to go to college. We have successfully lobbied with the Army to get that program changed back, and you'll actually be able to see, and I'm going to do something I should never do, and I'm going to jump out of this. So over time, this chart depicts in the brown line the users of the Federal Tuition Assistance Program. And you'll see that the policy change occurred in state fiscal year 13 that reduced the ability of our members to use that to below 600 members a year. And in 17, we were able to get that policy changed, opening that back up. And so the number of users of FTA actually went down. So this is on slide 13 in your packets. But trying to accommodate the cost change that we had in STR, Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer, that's what forced us to put limitations and constraints on the reenlistment and the enlistment bonuses in the state.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Kerr, so we're talking federal dollars here? No.
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, no. This is all state money, but it's affected by federal money. So we don't pay people twice. If they're eligible for a federal benefit, we don't use our state funds to do the same thing so that we can make those state dollars go further. But when those federal dollars were restricted, we had to increase the amount that we were paying. We have, no control is the wrong word, but we don't control the federal reenlistment bonus, and I want to make sure you understand that the state bonus program is what we shut down. Federal bonuses are still in effect, and frankly, in the last 2 years, those floodgates have opened dramatically, and we haven't seen a very negative impact of reducing our state reenlistment bonus or our state enlistment bonus, because there are corresponding federal bonuses that have offset those benefits to our service members.
Representative Detmer?
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kerr?
So there's a lot of data in here, Mr. Chair, and in the interest of brevity, I'll just kind of go on, but I'll leave it with the members in case you want to come back and ask us about it later. But you can see, you get a general idea as we go through the slides of how the utilization of our program has ebbed and flowed, mostly ebbed in the last couple of years, but we had some high utilization in 16 and 17 that we didn't anticipate. And one of the things that we know after looking at this for 10 years is we have a hard time forecasting exactly what factors influence our service members to go to college or not go to college. We thought the deployment cycle would have a lot to do with it, but we haven't been able to make a direct correlation to that. We thought the economy might have a lot to do with it. We haven't been able to make a direct correlation to that. So what we're doing is we're trying to use as much historical data as we can to make the best estimates that we can moving forward on what our resource requirements will be. So this is another picture of that state tuition reimbursement versus the federal tuition assistance thing. Again, the brown being FTA. You can see that we were using a lot of money in 12, 13, less than 14, and it dropped off almost nothing. And correspondingly, the amount of state money we had to put into the program went up.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you could... I'm going to be naive to what applies for this education, some of this funding. I mean, is it for your colleges? Is it what are the defining lines of what would be considered reimbursable education opportunities?
Mr. Kerr.
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller. So We basically reimburse education at any accredited institution. It can be a four-year or a two-year state school. It can be a four-year, two-year private. It can be a trade school. Anything that's accredited, we will do tuition reimbursement for. The amount of tuition that we reimburse at the baccalaureate level and below is up to 100% of the University of Minnesota tuition rate, and for graduate programs, up to 50% of the University of Minnesota graduate rate.
Mr. Chair, just one quick follow-up. Thank you. What about things that would be considered under the category of customized training? So, for example, a two-semester program, a three-semester program, where you don't receive an AA or a BA or anything like that?
Mr. Kerr.
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, if it's a two-semester program or a three-semester program at an accredited institution, it's reimbursable.
Okay. Representative Miller.
So, Mr. Chair, now finally on to Representative Detmer's question. So the reintegration appropriation is our second change item. Reintegration is defined as the process of transitioning from the deployment experience as a warrior back to a citizen in our community. We did receive that one-time appropriation of $1.5 million back in 2008, and we project to expend the remainder of that during the current fiscal year. We do provide, so to do that, what we do that with that money is we spend it to provide things that we can't get on the federal side to support our reintegration activities. And that could be feeding our service members and their families when they're coming to these activities. It could be educational materials that we use in lieu of that. And we have also spent some money traveling to bring members of other state government agencies and civilian volunteers to our service members at the mobilization stations, or in the case of the 1st Brigade Combat Team, we actually sent a significant contingent of folks to Kuwait so that they could start working, because we had reports back from the unit deployed that they were going to have a very large number of their service members who were unemployed when they were going to return, in excess of 24% of the brigade, which is significant because it was a 4,000-man brigade. So we were talking about 1,000 people who were going to come back to Minnesota without a job. So we mobilized a whole bunch of resources, not only from DEED, but also from private industry, to get help to those service members so they could get into the job market early, learn how to do an appropriate resume so that they could be hired, and we actually ran that thing down to less than 1% unemployed when they came home.
Mr. Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be more education for me being new on this committee, so whoever wants to fill me in can do that. Back when I was in, it was this Sailor Soldier Relief Act that sort of, like, if you will, guaranteed your job when you came back. Can you give me, I guess it's two-part, have there been changes over the years to that, or can you give me sort of where that falls through the cracks? Because I thought if you get deployed, you come back, your job's there. So can you clarify that for me? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, that's true if you have a job when you leave.
Okay, got it.
And there's actually, the state's been very good about a parallel law in Minnesota that protects a broader base than the SCRA does. SCRA only protects in federal service, and the state law actually protects in state service as well.
Representative Miller? Mr. Chair, and I guess committee probably with this, my son's in the National Guard, and I'm guessing it's because of the continual deployments over the last several years, but there has been sort of, he's mentioned to me that you're kind of careful when you say, when you're looking for a job, that you're in the National Guard. Ironically, I think the National Guard, because we in Minnesota, the National Guard gets deployed, right? But it can be a perceived job deterrent, and we may want to look at some point into if that's just simply perceived by someone like my son, or if that's a real issue, because that's really the front end of the problem that we're talking about. Like, if they say I'm in the National Guard, that's a clue to an employer I might lose them in the next year or so, and for a time being. So I think we need to address that at some point. If we haven't already, again, maybe with history.
Yeah, Representative Miller, I also share concerns. One of my former colleagues, who also serves in the National Guard, said the same thing to me, too. And so I definitely would love to sit down and chat with you some more on that to see if it's just a perception or if it is a real issue amongst our servicemen and women.
Would you like to address that? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, I can give a little bit. Yeah, I think it's more than a perception. We believe it is a reality. That's something that we're very concerned about. We're always trying to watch the legislation that passes and the activities of employers to make sure that we're not doing things inadvertently that could discourage employers from hiring members of the National Guard. But there's also an activity, Department of Defense activity, called Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve. And their role, they're actually federally funded, and their role is to go out and conduct liaison with employers to make sure that they know their requirements under the law to employ members of the Guard and Reserve. And it is illegal to discriminate against someone because they're in the Guard or Reserve from an employment perspective. But that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. And sometimes, about every 5 years, there's an egregious incident where some employer clearly doesn't understand their role under the law and makes some crazy statement, and it gets run tarred and feathered, and, you know, yay for them. But for the most part, it's something that we're conscious of, and we certainly think anything we can do to incentivize employers is very important, because that will help make sure that they're not inadvertently or advertently discriminating against members of the Guard and Reserve, because they're an important part of our national defense strategy, frankly.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Kurd, in the reintegration program, how much time is spent with the soldiers when they're coming back, say if they were on the battlefield, and helping them get back into the civilian world in terms, you know, maybe some psychological issues and some PTSD and so forth. What happens in reintegration program?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, there are a number of things that happen, and really we look at it through the entire deployment cycle. It's not just what happens after you come back, but it's what support do we provide to the service members and their families before they deploy, their families while they're deployed, and then their service member and their family after they return. And we had a three-activity program that was part of the actual reintegration program on the federal side, where approximately a month after your redeployment, your unit would come back together, and we had a very fixed set of things that we went through. And then you came in another 30 days later, and there was a different set of things that we did with the families and the service members. And what we found is that gap in time is important, because sometimes things develop, maybe not the day you get home or maybe not the week you get home, but maybe the month after you get home, you start seeing some changes. And there are a lot of transitional things that families have to go through. Often a lot of the responsibilities inside the family shift during a deployment. Someone who may have been the primary breadwinner and paid all the bills suddenly is in Iraq, and the secondary member winds up being the bill payer, and then the first primary member comes back and they want to start paying the bills again, and it's really not so fast. I kind of got used to that, and I know where everything is, and I know how much we're doing, and that's not your deal anymore. And so there's a lot of negotiation that has to occur inside the family unit during and after a deployment. So we try to use those activities, in addition to the ones that we do while they're deployed and before they deploy, to cover down on most of those activities. And, of course, there's a lot of resources available. We utilize the VA whenever we can and whenever that's appropriate. But there are also some local community resources, depending on which community you're in. And if you'll recall, the agency briefing that we did was beyond the Yellow Ribbon networks in each community are very important to helping people reintegrate in their community.
Thank you.
Again, some more data. This is what we spent that money on, to give you an idea, broadly categorized as advertising, educational, food, printing, rental, and supplies, and then you see the travel. You can see where we sent the folks overseas is year 12. We had $123,000 in travel costs. But that's the kind of stuff we've done. We feel that we've been very frugal in that 1.5 mil, but it's time to refeed that thing. And we do have some significant deployments on the near horizon. We have the 34th Division headquarters with about 900 service members overseas right now. They'll be returning in July. We've also got the Combat Aviation Brigade, about another 800 service members going out in December. And our infantry battalion is going out in June. So we've got a number of deployment activities upcoming. And we feel it's important to have the funds available to support those activities. I'm going to blow by that one and get back to this one. So what happens if we don't get the change items? We'll have reduced availability for higher education funding. The way the math comes out, 848 newly enlisted members in the last 2 years are from diverse communities. So we think that there is a socioeconomic impact to this thing. The short answer is, if somebody doesn't have a way to pay for college, we can fix that. And we want to make sure that we make those opportunities available. Without the additional funding, we'll have a significant reduction to our incentive programs, and we're concerned about reduced services to our service members that are returning and their families that are in the deployment cycle.
Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering if there's any teamwork or correlation between the active duty service members that come back to our state. It seems like we're talking about, which is great, the National Guard. But we had a gentleman testify, I believe last week or the week before. The gentleman had 12 deployments, and it sounded like he was on active duty. And his testimony, he talked about the lack of kind of a debriefing process. So I was just wondering if there's, you know, people that may come back to the state of Minnesota that have been on active duty for 4 or 8 years maybe or longer, and how we can help them too.
Mr. Kerr.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinrich, so that really is more of a question for the other agency, because once they leave the Army, they're no longer part of my team, they're part of the Veterans Department's team. But I will tell you that there, it is a challenge in Minnesota because we don't have any active duty installations here. And so it's difficult for folks who transition off active duty and come back to Minnesota, or for those members that are on active duty, and it's not unusual for, if a service member deploys, for their family members to not stay at Fort Riley, but to rather go back home to be closer to mom and dad and their support network, and that's often in Minnesota. So to cover that aspect of it, I will tell you the family assistance centers that are run by the National Guard are actually a DOD activity, Department of Defense activity, and we service all branches, all components through those family assistance centers. That may not help your service member coming off active duty, but there are services that are available nationwide through DOD Military OneSource. And the Department of Veterans Affairs is very astute at being able to put people into contact. The key node is those county veteran service officers and convincing service members that are leaving active duty to immediately go interface with their servicing county veteran service officer. And I will tell you that the active component attempts to do that, because I've transitioned off active duty twice, and both times that was one of the key points that they were hitting us on, is to go back and interact with your CDSO, because you never know when you might need the benefits, and it's good for them to know where to find you. But if the service members don't regale themselves of that opportunity, it's just like everything else in our society.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dimmer. Mr. Chair, in terms of the 258,000, how'd you come to that number, being the average? Looks like it's the average is about 121,000. How'd you come up to that number?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, so we did a forecast of the known deployments that we have upcoming and the known cost increase that we're seeing right now, and understanding what the new program is that the Army is pushing and how that might affect it. And that is the estimate that we came up with, because we have this, you know, it's not going to be the highest that we've done, but it's going to be right up there with the highest that we've done over the next couple of years.
Okay. Representative Detmer.
Fine. Thank you.
Any more questions? All right, thank you, Mr. Kerr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative O'Neill, are you ready? All right, the chair moves that House File 203 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. Representative O'Neill, you may proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So this is a bill that actually was vetted and went through the big omnibus bill to the governor's desk, and of course that big bill was vetoed. So this is a good bill. It's just a little bit of a cleanup of something so that things can work a little more streamlined for our veterans. To the bill specifically, House File 203 allows a county veteran service officer to share necessary private data with a county assessor for the purpose of determining disabled veteran or survivor spouse eligibility for the market homestead value exclusion. So the homestead market value exclusion. And let me just talk about that just really quickly about what that means. The disabled veterans homestead market value exclusion excludes 150,000 of market value for veterans with disabilities ranging at 70% or more, and 300,000 of market value for veterans with a disability rating of total or permanent and permanent. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my testifier, because he does have to run to another meeting quickly. So I'll let him testify to the bill and the components.
All right, please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Matt Hilgart. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all 87 counties in the state of Minnesota. I want to thank the author for bringing this forward, and I think she did a great job of explaining what it does. The issue at core is, of course, in the application of the disabled veterans market value exclusion and the data sharing that is required for eligibility and certification of these benefits between the county veterans service officer, the CVSOs, and the county assessor who has the parcel information. And so in technicalities, I believe it's the Social Security number that's been the catch-up on this, but I want to come here today to say that not only AMC supports this, but the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers supports this bill, as well as the CVSO Association and the Minnesota Inter-County Association. I believe in members' packets, my colleague Keith Carlson from the Minnesota Inter-County Association wrote up a very brief summary of what the actual issue is right now. But we appreciate your support, and we appreciate the author's work on this.
Okay, is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 203? Questions? All right, the chair renews his motion that House File 203 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law decision. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Grasso. Representative Grasso, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, sir, I would.
Representative Grasso moves that House File 172 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on GovOps. Representative Grasso, proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. House File 172, POW MIA Recognition Day. There are more than 82,000 American military servicemen or service members, including more than 1,500 from Minnesota, missing, unaccounted for, or uncoverable deep sea losses. It is the federal government's duty to continue to try to bring our prisoners of war and missing in action home. And it is our duty as citizens to never forget the POWs and MIAs. A POW MIA flag flies above the House chamber, bearing the motto, "You are not forgotten." Think about that. You are not forgotten. You may have seen the missing man table at a local American Legion or VFW. If you look in your packets, there's a handout in there, a photograph of one of these missing man tables. The missing man table is round, with a white tablecloth, a single red rose in a vase, on the table with a red or yellow ribbon wrapped around the vase. On the table there is a lemon slice on a plate, a salt shaker, an inverted glass, a holy Bible, lit candle, and empty chairs. Again, I directed you to the photograph. I want to take a minute to talk about the symbolism of these items. The table is round to represent everlasting concern for our loved ones who are POWs or MIAs. The tablecloth is white, symbolic of the purity of the soldiers' intentions in response to their country's call on them, call to arms. The red rose signifies the blood that many soldiers have shed so that we can be free. The ribbon around the vase symbolizes continued hope for the soldiers' return. The lemon slice represents the bitter fate of the missing. The salt reminds us of the countless tears of the families who wait at home for their loved ones' return. The inverted glass represents the fact that missing cannot partake. The Holy Bible is a symbolic of a spiritual strength and faith to sustain those who are lost. The lit candle represents the hope for those soldiers' return, and the empty chairs, A reminder to us of the missing soldiers who are not present at the table. U.S. Congress passed a resolution authorizing a National POW MIA Recognition Day in 1979. Since 1986, the date has been on a third Friday in September. Each year, the President proclaims a National POW MIA Recognition Day. Many states also make this designation. Last year, a constituent brought to then Representative Jason Rarick's attention days before September 21st, the third Friday in September last year, that 48 of 50 states had proclaimed the date. Only Minnesota and California hadn't. Representative Rarick was able to get Governor Dayton to issue a proclamation last minute and also had a House resolution issued. House File 172 puts in the statute that the third Friday in September every year is designated as POW and MIA Recognition Day and requires the governor to issue a proclamation. There are many days of observance in state law that require the governor to issue a proclamation, including July is Higher Veterans Month. The Sunday before Memorial Day is Military Spouses and Family Day. August 7th is Combat Wounded Purple Heart Day. It is our continued duty as citizens to never forget that there are U.S. military service personnel who are prisoners of war and missing in action. Having the third Friday of every September designated in statute for recognition of the POWs and MIAs will help us remember that they are not forgotten. Thank you again, Mr. Chair and committee, for hearing the bill, and I ask for this, the committee's favorable decision.
Thank you for consideration. Also, you folks in the audience would like to testify, please come on down and identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and member of the committee. My name is Jerry Kaiser. I'm the chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council, but I'm also the executive director of Minnesota Vietnam Veterans Charity. Since 2001, the Minnesota Vietnam Veterans Charity has sponsored the POW MIA Day, along with the University of Minnesota, both on the campus here of the state capitol and at the University of Minnesota. The organization we failed is proper to do that. He's absolutely correct. The only way that we get recognition of this right now is like last year, Representative Detmer gave us the proclamation for the POW MIA Day when we brought back a MIA and had him that person repositioned in Fort Snelling. And each year we also facilitate and provide missing man formation flyover of four T-6 Texans, and sometimes we put a B-25 with it, all sponsored by Minnesota Vietnam Veterans Charity. It's an honor for us to have this as a reminder of all those who have not made it. The POWs, as a matter of fact, organization in Minnesota has folded its tent. They are almost all gone, and they are not able to keep their organization going. The gentleman who was their president spoke at our last POW MIA Day at the University of Minnesota, and it is sad to say that all of them in the state of Minnesota, as far as World War II, are not available. There are very few Korea ex-POWs and one or two ex-Vietnam ex-POWs. So this is a great recognition to have this on the books that we should be following, just the same as the other states of the, that be only California left. So thank you, Representative, for putting this forth, and we appreciate it. This year, we will be doing it again at University of Minnesota with Missing Man Formation Flyover. You should come and see it. It is a great day. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kaiser. All right. Chair News is motion that House File 172 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on GovOps. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails. All right, our next meeting is Tuesday at 2:30 right here in this room. And we're adjourned.